You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. HRN is food radio supported by you. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
This episode is brought to you by Cheese State University. Cheese State University was created for dedicated cheese professionals seeking to deepen their knowledge, sharpen their skills, and build connections. Join them in the Ivy League of cheese education at cheesestateuniversity.com.
This is What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights. I'm your host, Katie Kiefer. And today we are speaking with Bryce Oates, who's actually been on the show at least once, maybe twice. He is a writer covering rural policy, people, places, and politics. His work includes articles on federal farm and food policy, public lands and conservation issues, racial and gender equity in rural areas, climate change, economic inequality, rural demographic data, and the many iterations of quote-unquote rural poverty. Sorry about that. Oates is the rural policy correspondent for the Daily Yonder and a freelancer for other publications, including my favorite and yours, Civil Eats and Outdoor Life, and of course, a new publication that just got off the ground called The Barn Raiser. But why he's on the show today, aside from his general expertise in all things rural, is that Bryce has just launched a new newsletter called The Cockle Burr. And The Cockle Burr covers rural policy and politics from a progressive point of view. Interesting. And his work focuses on a tangled rural political reality of dishonest debate, economic and racial disparities, corporate power over our democracy, and disinformation peddled by conservative media outlets. Strong words indeed, Bryce. He and his staff aim to use facts, data, and science to inform their point of view. They wear their complicated love WTF relationship with rural America on their sleeve. Wonderful description of the Cockle Burr, and you couldn't have named it better. You couldn't have named it better if you tried. I mean, really.
I did try.
Yeah, right. Exactly. It shows you picked the right name. So that's it. That's an exciting development in your life. So let's talk about that for a few minutes before we dive into some of the issues that you have covered and will continue to cover. How often is the Cockle Burr going to come out, for starters?
2 to 3 times a week to begin with. I'd like to expand that to every day, and even hire a couple writers if it really takes off.
Great.
It's been going on for getting on a couple of weeks now, and it's going really well. People are really donating. It is a free newsletter for all, so I want to make that clear.
Right.
But donors are really picking up steam, and
that's great, Bryce.
I'm feeling very confident about it. Yeah.
Right. That's terrific. And so just to reiterate, what kind of topics are you planning on covering?
So I want to cover rural voters and rural politics, sort of the complicated mess. A lot of times we hear from pundits and the mainstream media questions about, you know, what the heck is wrong with rural voters? I'm a rural voter. I come from rural people, working class and poor rural people. And I kind of have the same questions. And so I really wanted to dip into that. For instance, you know, we hear a lot about soccer moms, but we don't hear much about the deer hunting dads out there in rural America.
Very good point.
We hear a lot about, you know, security dads sometimes in the suburbs, right? But we don't really hear about SNAP voters or, you know, a lot of my friends and neighbors who work in gas stations or who, you know, who work in cafes and are, you know, paid on tip wages. And so it's very frustrating that the complicated picture that is rural America painted by the mainstream media, I think it's just very misunderstood. And I think that there's a lot of reasons why rural voters do what they do. And I really want to dip into that. And on the second hand, I'm a person of privilege who first person in my family to graduate from college. And I've, you know, been to D.C. a lot, and I cover Washington, the House and Senate Agriculture Committees, federal policy.
Right.
I watch these debates play out, and I never really had an outlet for sort of the day-to-day patterns that I saw and sort of the moment-to-moment things that happen in the Capitol that I'd like to really report. And I think that my audience you know, appreciates a lot more in-depth news like that. And so this is really just a compliment to the freelance reporting I'm doing for Daily Yonder the other outlets.
Right, right. And how will your slant, say, differ from, I don't know, Civil Eats or Food Fix, you know, Helena Butler, Evich's Place? Or
I think in some ways, like Civil Eats and Food Fix, they're doing wonderful stuff. My work is a little bit more broad in the rural way. You know, it's not just focused on food and agriculture.
Right.
You know, it's more about forestry, rural economic development, the different patterns cool. that exist in rural. I'm doing a deep dive into rural housing. Currently, I have been unhoused in my rural community for about 5 months because of I'm a renter and I had an issue with the house. And so I've been sort of, going from hotel to hotel to Airbnb to Airbnb.
Oof.
Anyway, that's not the only reason I'm back in rural Missouri with my family I grew up with. But it is one. And so that house isn't going to get back up to speed for a couple weeks. So, you know, it's been a real reality to me to see the challenges of rural housing that just doesn't exist in many places, especially rental housing or affordable places to live for somebody who has a moment of, you know, unhoused reality.
Right, right. It is amazing how little that is covered because certainly around where I live, and I live in quite a rural area in southern Rhode Island, and there is almost no rental housing to be had.
Yeah.
I mean, part of that is because of the huge influx of people who came, fleeing from COVID from these bigger cities. And that, to some extent, has kind of died down. But the reality is that, you know, there are other places that are desirable, my own house included, that I'm renting out to summer visitors because I could make a huge amount of money doing that.
But that
means that other people can't live in that house, right?
Right.
Families that need that housing don't have access to it. So.
Right. And I think it's been a really rapid change and then maybe a shocking change to some people. And so
it's shocking to the elderly, man.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Right.
You don't have anywhere
to go either. Right.
And you have no place to go and you don't have family or friends you can crash with. I mean, I don't know what you do then.
Yeah. Luckily I'm in my middle 40s and I'm in pretty good shape. I guess sort of good shape, but, I can just throw my sleeping pad out on the floor or even on the Amtrak, which I did for a while, in the last few months. So
brutal.
It's not that brutal. I had a good experience, but it can be brutal. But it does show you a lot of things about the reality of the rural housing crisis out there.
Right. And what about broadband? I know we're getting way off the topic here, but, you know, you hear a lot about because of course, that's why I have an outline, Bryce, because otherwise I have terrible ADD and I cannot stay on a topic.
I'm with you.
But I'm just curious, like, since we're talking about housing, you know, broadband is something we all hear a lot about. And that was part of Biden's, you know, many initiatives to kind of repair and recharge America. do you see that as big a problem as it's painted to be in mainstream media?
Yes. I do.
Why is that? There are no cell towers out in Missouri or Kansas?
I just maybe I'll explain it just by the word broadband itself is confusing to people.
Yes.
Really, I speak of it as high-speed internet access.
Right.
So it doesn't matter if it's fiber or if it's over the air, right?
Right.
Literally, I'm standing here, sitting here in my parents' extra bedroom, and they did not have access to high-speed internet in west rural Missouri, roughly, you know, an hour and a half south of Kansas City. Until about 6 months ago. So they
God.
So not only
how do people communicate?
I wouldn't be here staying with them right now and using and on this radio station if they didn't have internet like that, right?
Absolutely.
So I don't know what I would have done because I can't work without high speed internet as a freelancer.
Of course.
And so I'm just saying, I think that shows two things. One, the difficulties people have with visiting family, with traveling out into the rural areas of America, even living out in the rural areas. And then two, you know, things are actually getting done and getting better in rural America due to federal investment in the high speed internet. And I think that the infrastructure bill and, you know, and Inflation Reduction Act, not necessarily on internet stuff, but the American Rescue Plan Act, you know, things are actually getting better and improving. I think we need more money, and I think we need more focus on that issue, yes.
But, well, do you think, I mean, given that the rural America tends to slant towards the Republican Party, are those voters conscious of the improvement in their, you know, infrastructure, high-speed internet access, or what have you? Are all of the things that were brought by the big federal infusions of cash into the states, are they... Do you think that will switch their party affiliation, or will they continue to vote for, you know, Chuck Grassley, Mitch McConnell, you know, the usual roster of aging white men out of touch with real life?
Well, I'm going to set high-speed internet access aside a bit, because on one, I don't think it'll switch them, because I do think a lot of Republicans, Chuck Grassley, you mentioned, Mitch McConnell, et cetera, they do actually support. And it's a very, very, very rare area where Republicans have actually made some choices to increase federal investment in rural communities is the internet. And so I think that just shows that's a good example of what happens when what I would call a progressive Democratic priority gets embraced by the Republicans. Mm-hmm. And that took years and years and years of the Democrats hammering on this issue before they finally relented. The Republicans relented,
and but in the sense that they agreed to fund increased access. Yeah, I mean, it's so interesting to me that that it took that long, and that voters were not more vocal in demanding it from their Republican leaders.
I think asking voters. I mean, voters are complicated, but I think asking them to vote on high-speed internet access alone is probably not something that they're going to vote on. I mean, my mother is, you know, 66. She's sitting in the other room over there. She's never been on the internet once. And unfortunately, that's the reality of a lot of people in rural America. Mm-hmm. So again, there's just a constituency in rural communities. They're not going to vote on internet access alone. Now, I see high-speed internet access as an issue of justice, and I do think every rural community should have it. And I do think that the other reason why people don't vote on it is Democrats, in my opinion, don't use issues like high-speed internet access and Republican obstruction to it as the wedge that they should. So that's part of the reason I started the Cuckoo Bar, frankly, is that there are issues that I see in rural America that are incredibly popular. And we're getting ready to talk about the Clean Water Act, say.
Yes.
and that corporate power is another one. Industrial livestock facilities, CAFOs, however you want to describe it, as another. When Democrats don't talk about them, then why would voters have any interest in making a choice based on those issues? In other words, if Democrats prioritized those issues and made clear distinctions between themselves and Republicans, then voters would have a clear choice. Right now, I think many Democrats don't do that. I think some do, but I think many don't.
I also think that when they do, like I'm thinking back to when in the last presidential primary, it was when Trump was running for president, and Elizabeth Warren, I think it was then, Elizabeth Warren and Cory Booker came out, and they were like all over the, you know, industrial agriculture, and we need to like break up these monopolies, and you know, blah blah blah, and by extension, you know, clean up some of the environmental degradation that follows from industrial ag, and Republicans were quick to say, well, you're not connecting with the rural voter. These people depend on these facilities for their livelihoods, which, you know, if you really dig into it, turns out that's not true. But you know, the Democrats were allowed to be bulldozed by this, you know, alternative reality that the Republicans put forth, that A, the Democrats don't know what those issues are and don't understand them and therefore should never address them. And that they're, you know, silly and frivolous anyway, because they might take jobs away. I mean, I don't understand why that, you know, why those things why the mainstream media just continues to let the Republicans go with these stories that are utterly false.
There you know,
it's the same thing with comparing Hunter Biden's laptop to Jared Kushner getting $2.1 billion
completely
from the Saudi Arabians. You know what I mean? It's like, what? Like, that's not nepotism. Like, you're telling me that's not corrupt, but Hunter Biden, you know, being on the board, however inappropriate it was, is somehow worse. I mean, it's not even. Anyway, let's get on with our.
Yes, I agree 100%.
Let's talk about your. Yeah, go ahead. Sorry.
No, I guess one thing to say about the primary process. I don't think this clicks with a lot of people. You know, a lot of people are going to vote in the Republican primary. Who care about JFOs, right? So nobody in the Republican primary is offering them a solution on cleaning up industrial livestock facilities.
Right.
So, I mean, that's, again, even though that might be the biggest issue, say, in rural Iowa or eastern North Carolina, you know.
Or even in Missouri.
Or even in Missouri or southeastern Minnesota. Mm-hmm. They're still going to vote in the Republican primary. So they're not going to be talking about these issues in the media on the Republican side. They're going to get candidate surveys and stuff, again, during the primary. Talking about CAFOs and industrial livestock facilities. And unfortunately, even in the general election, CAFOs don't come up, you know, or environmental justice issues don't come up because the Democrats don't force it. And so, I mean, it's to me, it's bipartisan neglect about rural issues, about environmental justice. You know, again, with high-speed internet for a long time, but now that Republicans have kind of got on board the rural high-speed internet access train, then it's no longer an issue that matters for elections.
Right.
I want to push on the issues that matter to rural voters. And to me, it doesn't. And these are the people I know, people working on these issues, grassroots groups. So it doesn't matter to me whether it's I care about issues that are popular. It doesn't matter whether they do tend to be supported by Democrats in the national way rather than Republicans. That's true. But some Democrats also don't embrace the things that are going to be coming out in the cucklebar. For instance, I have my post later today will be somewhat critical of representative in Virginia who has embraced the Farm Bureau, sort of her rural strategy for getting elected in her area.
Right.
And so, you know, she's a leading House Democrat and
who's that, Spanberger?
You got it.
Yeah.
And I was getting ready to say.
Sorry.
So it's great. I do like her in a lot of ways. She has voted for a lot of the things that matter. She voted for the bipartisan infrastructure bill. She voted for the Inflation Reduction Act.
Yeah.
I mean, she even supported WOTUS, which we're going to talk about.
Right.
In the resolution. So, I mean, but also she reaches out constantly to the Farm Bureau. She just had a hearing, a Farm Bill summit yesterday in her district. And the two lead speakers were from the Farm Bureau.
Right.
I mean, that's
we should explain what the Farm Bureau is. There's plenty of people out there who don't know what that means.
Yeah, right. So the Farm Bureau, what they claim is they're the voice of agriculture. That's in their own words. They're a very large, the largest industrial livestock and industrial row crop lobby in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
They have a history of being anti-labor, anti-union, you know, very regressive rather than progressive. They're very, very much aligned with the Republican Party.
Yeah.
They're huge. The WOTUS issue we're going to talk about, they have been the lead organization, one of the lead organizations for sure in the country to promote misinformation and disinformation about how what they call, and I'm using my quotes here, burdensome regulations are going to lead to the end of agriculture and the family farm as we know it. Again, that's in their words. That's not at all true. There's never been a farm that's gotten run out of business because of regulations. There is no such thing as green police or environmental police out there.
Right.
They use hysteria to whip up, and this is a common tactic that they use, hysteria and misinformation. And so that this is the biggest reason that I started the Cucklebur is that, mm-hmm. is that I've grown up with and been around, that kind of misinformation my whole life,
mm-hmm.
rural agricultural media, the mainstream, even agricultural media, successful farming, AgriNews, publish regularly quotes by, they regularly publish and promote quotes from Farm Bureau and the politicians who they work closely with, generally right. Republicans, but again, some Democrats, who sort of chirp the talking points that the Farm Bureau produces. So maybe once we get to the Waters of the United States stuff, it might make a little more sense for people.
Well, let's go there right now. So your first iteration of the Cucklebur was a story about Waters of the United States. And this particular issue has been a Republican talking point since the Obama administration and probably long before.
Right.
So what we're talking about is whether or not the EPA via the Clean Water Act, has the authority to regulate bodies of water, I guess, mostly on farm, but really everywhere. So it's our rivers and streams, our lakes, our shorelines, all of that comes under the Clean Water Act. But Waters of the United States became a third rail because the Republican Party claimed that regulating any sort of effluent from farms was going to shut down family farms. But what we're really talking about is effluent from CAFOs and large industrial agricultural operations, right?
Well, not even that necessarily.
Really?
So the truth is about, I'll give you my WOTUS spiel and then we can move to how the Clean Water Act, you know, exempts nearly all of agriculture, right?
Right.
So the situation is that, so this, the what they call the WOTUS is the Waters of the United States. It really just clarifies which, like you said, Katie, which river streams, wetlands, shorelines are under regulation by the Federal Clean Water Act, which was passed in the early 70s in a bipartisan way. So there was a court case, and it made sure that the Obama administration, WOTUS rule, simply clarified which waters of the United States, because that's the language in the Clean Water Act, are under federal EPA, that's Environmental Protection Agency, permits. And so the truth is what this WOTUS rule does is actually clarifies what activities and not are part of the Clean Water Act. And the it actually exempts nearly every, I mean, by nearly, I mean 99.9% of agricultural activities, including regular farming, plowing, ranching, seeding, cultivating, harvesting, for doing forest practices, building ponds, dikes, levees, groins, riprap, irrigation ditches, anything dealing with farm roads, exempted our prior converted cropland. So what happened, you know, a lot of parts of the country, there's big giant row crop operations. They've been drained and tiled. That means sort of you take a ripper and you, you know, it's wet soils. It's like wetland soils, but not fully wet. And so they put a drainage system underneath it. And then that there's a drain pipe that runs to a creek or stream. So those are exempt. Any kind of water treatment system is exempt. Any farm ditch, any irrigated area that would revert to dry land if the irrigation wasn't there. Any lake or pond created by excavating or diking land, that's exempt. So basically, but that doesn't mean that the political debate has any merit in fact around this. Instead, the Republicans especially, and even a handful of Democrats, have said that, oh no, and if you listen to any congressional House or Senate hearing, you will hear these talking points put out by the Farm Bureau and put out by the Republicans. And even a number of the Chekhov-funded commodity groups, that's like the National Cattlemen's Beef Association.
Right, National Pork Producers Council.
There, we said it together. National Association, et cetera. You will hear them constantly rail, as you said, it's a third rail, on WOTUS as making it, you know, the EPA, the green police, they're going to regulate every river, every pond, every stream, every ditch that a farmer has to deal with. Well, that's simply not true. It's right there in the law.
Yeah.
It's right there in the Biden order on the Clean Water Act. It's right there in WOTUS that they are fully exempt. And so this whole debate has driven me crazy for many years because I'm simply hearing, you know, and watching hearing after hearing. It doesn't even matter. It could be about crop insurance. It could be about crop subsidies of a different kind. It could be about conservation programs. And the Republicans, one after another, keep talking about WOTUS as if that's going to be what they call, and they're wrong, and they're not even telling the truth, as the end of the family farm.
Right.
And so
what's in it for them, though? That's what I don't get. Like, why is the Farm Bureau? Why are these, like, if they're all exempt, why are they beefing about it?
They're also scared of any potential regulation because the truth is they know they're polluting the water.
Oh, yeah.
In rural America.
Hell yeah.
For
millions of times. Oh, my God.
And that
been doing this for 14 years. Oh, yeah. Exactly.
And the core issue is that agriculture is exempt from the Clean Water Act. I don't think, and the majority of rural Americans, I believe, and, you know, various research and surveys and polling has shown they support the Clean Water Act, and they think that industrial agriculture should be regulated. They don't think giant CAFOs, whether they be beef or hog or chicken or egg or any kind, should be polluting the water because we all, you know, like depend on our public water systems in one way or another, or we depend on wells out in rural America. And right. So there, we have very sensitive water systems. And whenever our rivers and streams and lakes are polluted, or whenever our groundwater is polluted, when it comes to wells, then that puts a cost on all of us in rural America. And so, I mean, we already pay high prices sometimes if we are on city water. We call it city water out in the country whenever it's piped to our houses rather than being on well.
Right.
So even if it's a tiny little town like I live in. So so even when we have city water, you know, it like we're paying, you know, $50, $60, $70 a month for water, but also we want it to be clean.
Yep.
And in most parts of the country where agriculture is the chief industry, that's not the case.
Yes, I've explored that. Yeah.
And that's absolutely what the Clean Water Act is there to prevent, right?
Yeah.
And so literally, the other thing that this whole debate gets wrong is that a permit is really just a license to operate. It doesn't prevent activities. You know, a permit does not prevent a CAFO from operating. It's simply, you know, a fee they pay their State Department of Natural Resources or, you know, or the equivalent.
Right.
To operate. And it lays out the steps they'll take, whether there's a spill, et cetera. And the state says, with a rubber stamp in most cases, okay.
Unfortunately, yes.
Go ahead and operate. And then when they spill, you know, there's supposed to be fines, legal implications. And most of the time there isn't. And so what's so maddening when you understand the truth about what's happening with water pollution throughout rural America, urban America too, is that those companies, those operations are really operating outside the law and they should be fined and they're not. And they're very, very, very rarely shut down if they violate their permit. And so they're given such wide latitude that, you know, I have seen and reported on pollution for years.
Yeah.
And I just don't see any reason why the WOTUS hysteria has been allowed to be reported as truth by the mainstream media or by the agriculture media.
Yeah, I totally agree.
It's really not. It's not. It's not true.
Yeah. It's not true. There's no accuracy to the reporting, and doesn't really understand what the issues are. We have to take a short break here. We'll be right back with Bryce Oates. Stay tuned right now for a sponsor drop. And until then.
Coming this spring, we're working on something big for opening soon.
Opening a restaurant can sometimes take months or even years.
So I have this one consulting client that's been 3 months away from opening for the past year.
And I had a calendar reminder show up today, and the reminder was that our goal was to open tomorrow.
But this spring, you'll be able to hear it in just a few hours.
On March 30th, he had passed away, and then on March 31st, he had come back to life. And then on April 2nd, he had passed away again. And I was like, okay, my regards to the family. I don't even know how to receive this information.
So tune in as we follow one of Brooklyn's best and brightest young chefs and restaurateurs on their journey from start to open doors.
Alex, you need to put more money in. We're out. We can't pay anybody.
He is the bratwurst. Oh my God, that guy.
It's The Build.
Subscribe to Opening Soon from Heritage Radio Network, wherever you listen to podcasts.
This episode is brought to you by Cheese State University. Cheese State University was created for dedicated cheese professionals seeking to deepen their knowledge, sharpen their skills, and build connections.
It feels like a gift to be able to give this gift to people, because I know that from my own experiences, I know how valuable, consolidated, incredible training resources are.
They offer an in-depth education on all things cheese, as well as an active network for peer support and career development.
You can pop over to the Quad, which is our social networking and engagement app. And so that's a really fun and dynamic aspect of Cheese State University.
Cheese State's three-part course is designed for seasoned pros and entry-level mongers alike, and covers all the skills one needs to perform on the cheese counter.
The structure of Cheese State University is all based on the Cheese State University Field Guide. And that is a three-volume resource. It's all digital, online.
At the end of the course, students will be ready to ace the field guide assessment and earn their Cheese State Scholar Certificate.
Another resource is a video series where we tackle sort of like these thornier questions that you can get on the cheese counter, like what is rennet and like why is this cheese so expensive and can pregnant people even eat cheese?
At Cheese State, you're among experts, you're among scholars, you're among cheese lovers, and most importantly, you are a monger. Join them in the Ivy League of Cheese Education at cheesestateuniversity.com.
So it turned out that, okay, so when Biden issued that new rule on WOTUS that you described in the before the break, the Senate immediately responded with a successful vote to repeal it. And then there was a House resolution, quote, providing for congressional disapproval, end quote. What I find extraordinary, especially in light of what we've just been talking about in terms of how unregulated even the lightest regulation is, you know, ends up being enforced. Why were so many Democratic lawmakers on board with the Republicans in repealing Biden's rule? And secondly, why isn't everyone on board with clean water? Because the amount of money it's going to cost to clean this up or deal with, you know, the fallout, the ultimate fallout of this is far more than it would cost for some, you know, company like Tyson to clean up their manure pit.
Right. Well, I mean, boy, that's the question.
But first of all, why do you think those, why do those Democrats, why did the Democrats vote in favor of the repeal? What was their, is that a money thing?
In terms of the House, we'll take a look at some of them. David Scott, Sanford Bishop, Angie Craig, Don Davis, Jim Costa. They're on the Agriculture Committee.
Right.
So they are constantly flooded with these talking points by Republicans, right?
Yeah.
And they do that thing when you, for people who don't watch House and Senate and hearings all the time, they might not know this, but there's this sort of fake, I would call it, air of, oh, we have to be, you know, even if we completely disagree on every issue, we say, my friend from Georgia, or, you know, they pretend to be buddies, even though they are really arguing in very heated ways a lot of the times.
Yeah.
And so I understand why that's important. There's the core. We need to have open and honest debate. The problem is, in this debate, there hasn't been any honesty. And I get so frustrated with, again, the Republicans and many Democrats, because I don't think that they actually read and are not clear about the legal implications or the regulatory implications of the things that they're voting on. Now, that's not a surprise, but it's also, in this case, the WOTUS case, the Clean Water Act case, it's very important because so many of those, I don't know if they have bad staffers. I don't know if the White House hasn't done a good enough job, although they have done a good job on WOTUS, in my opinion. But I don't know if the Democratic Party infrastructure is scared of Republican talking points. Because again, when you get into the rural media, almost everything you'll read is about how WOTUS is going to take away the family farm.
Yeah.
And so this whole misinformation campaign, in this case, has really built the momentum that that's what's caused some of those Democrats. And in the House or in the Senate, you got John Tester. You know,
that really surprised me.
Right? He's generally quite good
pretty liberal, right?
Issues of corporate power, environmental justice issues too.
Yep.
And so that did surprise me. But he might.
You should send him an issue of the Cucklebur. He needs to understand. I mean, I read the language. You know, it's like how could you possibly extrapolate from this language that the family farm is going to be regulated out of existence? I mean, it's just ridiculous.
Right.
Absolutely absurd.
Right. Right.
And there's not a breath of legislation about regulating the effluent from CAFOs.
Right. You know? I mean, there are a few thousand, I think it's around 6,000 industrial livestock facilities in the country who have Clean Water Act permits through their states, but the states manage the EPA regulations. That's how it works. So when I say the states, I don't want it to be confusing.
Mm-hmm.
But and those are the biggest livestock facilities in the country. So you've got 6,000-ish, you know, that goes up and down some. EPA permitted, Clean Water Act permitted facilities in the country. Katie, how many livestock operations are there? There's 6,000 permitted operations, but there's a million.
Oh, at least.
Livestock operations.
They don't actually have, I remember from Food and Water Watch telling me that they don't actually have a count of how many of these confinement facilities there are, because if it's under 1,000 head, they don't have to apply for a permit for
discharge. That's the whole point. So it's less than 1/10 of 1% of all livestock operations in the country who are regulated by the Clean Water Act. That's virtually nothing. And they should be, frankly, because of the huge risk that they cause with water pollution. And they have an enormous track record of polluting the water. Nitrogen pollution, other kinds of effluent.
Phosphorus, diseases, absolutely.
Phosphorus,
absolutely.
Yes.
Yep.
And so it's clear that they're a risk. And I think that they should absolutely be permitted and should be hugely fined when they break the law. They're breaking the law and it's not being enforced.
Right. Well, that's a whole second thing. But anyway, you followed up on the first piece with the second piece explaining that President Biden vetoed that congressional resolution about WOTUS. So what will happen next? Like, is WOTUS as it stands going to be allowed to be implemented?
Right. That's confusing. this is a question for the lawyers, unfortunately. WOTUS is in effect currently. The Biden WOTUS rule, the Biden WOTUS Clean Water Act clarification is the most accurate way I know how to say it, is actually in effect. That said, stays have been filed across the country and they've been issued in, I believe, Texas and Idaho currently, and maybe another by now. There's a Supreme Court case headed down the road and they are expected to issue a ruling on a Supreme Court case that has these issues in mind this summer. And so, basically we're sort of waiting on the courts to decide, unfortunately, for clarification of what will happen with the Biden WOTUS rule. That said, elections go a different way. Republicans win come 2024, just like Trump did. That Republican, whether it's Trump or another Republican, who, if they were to win in 2024, who would be in charge of the administration of the Clean Water Act, and they could again probably gut WOTUS if the Republicans were to win. Now, yeah, sure. If I were a Democrat, I would use that as a campaign issue. Because the Clean Water Act, again, polls at 80%+.
Right.
But Democrats are scared of talking about WOTUS because they don't know. They're obviously don't understand, or they're too scared of industrial livestock and the industrial agriculture lobbies and the Farm Bureau to actually speak truth on this issue. But in reality, it would seem to me that a clear campaign issue, if I were to speak to any politician and interview them, which I will be doing in 2024, right. I'll ask them if they support the Clean Water Act or not, and then go down the WOTUS road with them.
Right.
It would make sense if we had a political party that were, you know, to be in favor of clean water, they would do the same thing.
Right, right. Well, we're going to have to wrap it up here, but to me, I find it fascinating that we are unable in mainstream media and on television news, unable to present issues as fundamental as protecting our water supplies to the public in a way that conveys how important it is, no matter what your party affiliation is.
Yes.
Every single person on the planet needs clean water, and that's just not negotiable. And so why we cannot convey to the public in a meaningful and urgent way how serious our water supply problems are, how serious our water contamination issues are, and, you know, force people into really recognizing that this is a crisis for all of us. It's not just something that's happening out there in the Midwest, you know what I mean?
Definitely.
What is the big challenge there, though? Well, I mean, you wrote, your thing was totally clear. Like, you'd be an idiot not to understand.
I think so, too.
I mean? You have to be, deliberately blind to not understand.
I think it's because of the muddy water that politics create. Yeah. I mean, I really do. And I mean, I know that's a, you know, silly saying or whatever, and it's just a slogan, perhaps. But it's just sort of, it's maddening to think. I think it's because Democrats don't prioritize it, or Republicans don't. And Republicans can just say, well, I believe in clean water too, and then leave it at that. But this really needs to be dug into the details, right? Like, we need to figure out, as a democratic society, how we're going to actually deliver clean water to people.
Yeah.
We're just not doing that right now. To me, this should be one of the top political issues on the table.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree with you.
You know, it's not up to me. I get that. But when the mainstream media and when political pundits and when campaign strategists don't pay any attention to clean water, it's not going to get up there. It's not going to get on TV. It's not going to reach the levels that it should. But I also think that it's up to grassroots groups, and they're out there, and it's up to other people to really elevate this issue to the high level that it needs to be. Because, again, we really do all need clean water, and it's a slogan, yes. But it's so easy for Republicans or for opponents of clean water, if that's a thing. I would call them opponents of clean water if they're against
the Clean Water Act. Absolutely.
To just say, well, I believe in clean water. But it takes that extra effort to actually understand how federal policy matters in our lives. And I think that's what the media's job is. And that's what I'm going to try to do with the Cucklebar.
Right. Well, this is your moment, my dear, to promote yourself shamelessly. Tell people how they can sign up for the Cucklebur. And remember, it's free now, but Bryce definitely needs support with this.
Well, thank you. So it is a Substack newsletter. It's the cucklebur.substack.com, and it is free. So please sign up. And if you feel like you can afford to give a donation, that'd be great. And I'll keep writing pointed and sharp commentary on these issues, just like we talked about today.
That's right. Listen, Bryce, thank you so much. By the way, do you have a website people can go to read some of your other work?
Katie, I'm not very good at technology.
I have a website and I literally don't know how to use it.
Oh my gosh.
The Cucklebur, totally sympathetic.
com is the best place to get me. I am on Twitter, also at the Cucklebur,
Cucklebur.
I got back on Twitter. I was off for a while.
Right.
I thought I needed to figure out a way to promote things.
Yes, you do. And this was one of them. So I thank you very much. And I look forward to seeing the future of the Cucklebur. It looks great to me. I can't wait to talk to you again.
All right. Appreciate it, Katie.
Thanks an awful lot, Bryce.
You too.
Talk to you soon. And thanks to my sponsors, as always, for supporting the Heritage Radio Network and my show, and to all the listeners who tune in. See you next time. Thanks for listening. What Doesn't Kill You? Food Industry Insights is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.